KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
Necessary component for completing creation of that UGA. So that really was fully analyzed at the time that the UGA was proposed.
And we'll get to look at that again when we go back and do urban regulations, because we had to go back and change it to rural regulations to be compliant with GMA. And once we have the capacity for a sewer, we'll have that kind of work to do. And so the community will be involved at the appropriate stages when it happens. But anyway, I'll move the consent agenda since we can come.
Thank you.
I will second it and just say that I see a lot of great work being done here. Again, a number of road projects, forestry. So great work. Public Works looks like they've been busy.
Lots of good stuff in there. And to the funding of the sewer, of course, that was not $1.5 million that we just took out of the general fund to apply to it. We had state support, as a lot of these have federal support too, and that's how we get a lot of the important infrastructure work done. So we can't reallocate any of these funds. All right, the consent agenda has been moved and seconded. All in favor, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, that motion passes, and we do, as mentioned, have a very busy morning, but we will welcome Dr. Locke and Willie Bence on, and the listeners of KPTZ as well. And lay it on us, Thanksgiving week. How are we doing, Dr. Locke?
Well, good morning. Numbers-wise, things continue to get worse. Nationally, we're now over 3 million cases. We're averaging about 171,000 new cases confirmed a day, and that's a 54% increase over the last 2 weeks. Death rates are going up, too. As many know, we've exceeded the 250,000 milestone, and we're averaging about 1,200 deaths a day, and that's what's known as a lagging indicator. So as national rates go up, deaths don't go up right away. It takes 2 to 3 weeks, so we're expecting higher mortality rates in the coming weeks. And I summarize the national picture. The only states or territories that are doing well is Hawaii and the Northern Mariana Islands. Everyone else is experiencing these very rapid increases in COVID cases. And it's not unique to the United States. This is happening in Europe. They're facing major new outbreaks. There's new outbreaks in Asia, which had previously had this under pretty good control. So everyone's struggling with quarantine fatigue and the factor in the Northern Hemisphere that the fact that as the weather turns colder, the risk of virus transmission increases. In Jefferson County, we've had some significant increases. So this last week we had 27 cases. The week before we had 23 cases. And so that's 50 cases over a two-week period, and that converts to a case rate of 156.74 per 100,000 times 2 weeks. And that might go up even a little more, is that we may get some test results from that were taken on Saturday that will come in today. And that's longer than it usually takes, and that's yet another problem we're facing, is that as the labs are doing this very high volume testing, over 40,000 tests a day in Washington State, the turnaround time is slowing down, and that really compromises our ability to contain the infection. Collin County's having a similar surge. They're up to 423 cases total, 149 cases per 100,000 and 6.4% positivity. Kitsap is even higher at 176 per 100,000 and 5.9% positivity, and they're having a new outbreak at St. Michael's Hospital. And the Olympic and Kitsap Peninsula are doing significantly better than other areas of the state. So King County is one of the worst. Also in eastern Washington, along the Idaho border, these are counties with rates in the 300 to 400 per 100,000. Some of the very small counties have rates in the thousands, like 1,500 cases per 100,000. So an important thing for people to realize when we're seeing these higher rates is that it's really stressing the ability to do high quality case investigation and contact tracing. That system around the state hasn't really broken down, but it's really not able to keep up with these case levels. And so counties, actually many counties, have had to stop doing contact tracing. They can only investigate cases, and the cases have to inform their contacts that they've been exposed. In Jefferson County, we've invested a lot in training investigators. We have 11 trained investigators, and even though they've been working really hard and working shifts throughout the weekend, we've been able to keep up with this surge. But for everyone, there comes a point where you have to cut back on what you're doing and just focus on the highest priority things. And part of this is that this system of isolation and quarantine is what's known as disease suppression. And it works if you have fairly low levels of disease. If you can keep your case counts below about 50 a day, you can keep it under control with testing and tracking and isolation. That's what we've been doing for a number of months. But at a certain point, you cannot suppress runaway infection with case investigation. It just doesn't work. And that's when you have to move to these mitigations, which is what the governor's doing now. It's that mitigations are when isolation and quarantine fails as a control mechanism. And there you have to start shutting restaurants and restricting activities. A number of states have gone to curfews, and that might be what's next for Washington State. Because as it's been from the very beginning, we can't afford to let our hospitals surge out. The hospitals are under extreme strain now, and it's not so much a lack of bed, it's a lack of people to staff those beds. And if we get in a situation where our hospitals are completely filled with COVID patients, there's no room for all the other people who need that. So that's something that at least Washington State is committed to not letting that happen or to do everything we can to prevent it. And then finally, before I get to the questions from the KPTZ listeners, as you mentioned, the holidays are extreme concern to us. We're heading into what's traditionally the highest travel time of the year, and CDC and Department of Health and Jefferson County Public Health, we are all recommending an extreme remedy is that people don't travel. They cancel their travel plans. They have household only Thanksgiving celebrations. But we know a lot of people are not going to do that. Over this Friday through Sunday, was the highest travel volume at airports since the pandemic began. 3 million people traveled over this last weekend, and that will increase. Wednesday is typically the highest travel day of the Thanksgiving holiday. So we think as many as 50 million people will travel either in-state or between states for these holidays, and that if they don't substantially modify their behavior, a lot will come back to Washington State infected. We're really working on that too. We have that quarantine policy. If you're out of state, you need to quarantine for 2 weeks. We really need to stress that. We need employers to enforce that because we have seen this over and over again in Jefferson County. It's people coming from out of state, they get exposed, they feel fine, but they end up exposing others, especially vulnerable populations.
Excuse me, Dr. Locke, it's not just about travel out of state, but as you were mentioning, the Olympic Peninsula has a lower incidence than other areas of the state. So if people travel to other communities in Washington state, they could also be transmitting back to.
Yeah, very definitely. And it especially matters what you do as a result of that travel. You know, if you're traveling somewhere and you stay in your car and you really restrict your interactions, the risk is relatively low. But if you're going to a family gathering where people are going to sit around the table unmasked and let down their guard, then your risk could be very high. If you have relatives in Spokane, for instance, you would be at a dramatically increased risk. So that's what we're up against. The first KPTZ question asked, the first one was about non-urgent medical and dental visits. Should we put those off until some future date? And my recommendation is if you can get an appointment, do it. The system's already I know Jefferson Healthcare is working at above their usual capacity. So appointments for preventive care may be limited, but if you can get an appointment, I wouldn't put it off. And I'd especially say that's true for dental conditions, where the longer you wait, the worse the condition often is and the more extreme the treatment needs to be. So if you can get an appointment, do it. The next question asked if sort of what we've learned from positive cases and how does that inform what we should do. And I think we talked about this a lot, that you know where we have our best information about infection control is in hospitals and healthcare facilities and nursing homes. We've been doing that forever for a whole variety of diseases. What in effect we're trying to do for the society at large is extend those infection control principles of masking and distancing and hygiene standards out to the general public. And the more people do it, the more effective it is. But the unique challenge of COVID-19 is the high asymptomatic rate. You just cannot tell who's infected. And so our natural tendency to trust people we know and let down our guard is really dangerous with this infection because that, you know, that best friend could be infected with this virus and have no knowledge of that whatsoever. We think asymptomatic infection now is running in the 40 to 50% range of cases. And people should always remember these case numbers we're talking about are just the tip of the iceberg. We think now at our very high testing levels that we probably have 5 unknown cases for every known case. We used to think that when we were doing less testing, we used to think that ratio was 10 to 1. But now the research says it's more like 5 to 1 in Washington State. So we are picking up more cases, but still, most of them are people who do not know that they're infected because they've never been tested. There was a question about the long-term impacts of COVID-19 infection. You know, what are known sort of informally as the long haulers, and what's known formally as post-acute COVID-19 syndrome. This is a significant phenomenon. We think that 10% of people who experience COVID-19 have some sort of residual symptoms, chronic cough, shortness of breath, joint pain, chronic fatigue, loss of sense of smell and taste, potentially permanently. And why this is, no one's sure. There appears to be significant tissue damage from COVID-19, and it may have to do with the damage caused by our immune system. The reason we survive COVID-19 is our immune system battles it off, but the battleground is us. And so our lungs and our tissue can be damaged in this process. And we don't know if it'll be permanent or not. It just hasn't been around. But we do know that people who developed infection early on in the pandemic are still having lingering symptoms.
Just clarifying on that a little bit, you say 10% might have long-term effects. Those are 10% of the 50 to 60% of people that have symptoms, right? Are there any long-term effects if you're asymptomatic?
Yes, that's 10% of confirmed cases. This was a Journal of the American Medical Association study that just came out that's considered the best study on that. They came up with 10% of confirmed cases.
And is that is it correlated with more highly symptomatic, the worse infection you had? Is that linked to?
So the lung disease definitely is correlated with severity of illness. I don't know if the other symptoms, and in fact, some of the other symptoms can develop after you've resolved the infection. So there are people having this loss of sense of smell and taste, not during the infection, but in the aftermath of it. And that very likely is an immunologic phenomenon, because the infection's gone at that point. Let's see, there a question about surgical mask versus cloth masks and which are better. And that's a hard question to answer, because certainly surgical and N95 masks are, we have a lot better data on them, because they're made for healthcare facilities, they're regulated, they have manufacturing standards. We are starting to see some good studies finally of cloth masks. And cloth masks vary a great deal depending on the quality of the materials and how they're manufactured. So some of them rival these manufactured medical masks. And others do not perform near as well. And as a general rule, virtually any kind of face covering works well for source control. But where they differ is in the filtration, you know, how well they filter the air you're breathing in. And that's a factor of, there's mechanical filtration, which is just, you know, the pulling air through a web of fibers. But what's a lot harder to measure is what's called electrostatic filtration. That's how things like N95 masks work, is the materials cause this electrical field to be generated that pulls really tiny particles out of the airstream. And people are learning ways to add that to cloth masks. You know, you put in a layer of a synthetic material or silk or something, some dissimilar fabric that causes electrostatic forces to set up. So I think cloth masks are getting better and better. They often fit better than surgical masks, and they have the huge benefit of being reusable. And there are studies that say when you wash masks, it does not degrade the filtration. So washing them is a good idea. It makes them more comfortable because they're softer, and it's a more ecologic thing. So the key is everyone needs a face covering. Let's see, questions about testing and delay. You know, people can't get same-day testing, and that's very true. The testing facilities locally are sort of at capacity, and delays are starting, and the hospital, Jefferson Healthcare, is working to expand their testing capacity. It's difficult because it's a staffing issue. It's easy to set up more lanes and drive more cars through, but having people, pulling people away from the clinics and hospital duties to staff those is the problem. But nonetheless, they're trying to do it. But we have, it's definitely happening that people can't get same day testing, especially if they're not ill, if they're just having it for some other reason. Yes?
Do you know, I think before you were talking about 60 to 80 tests per day, do you know what the capacity currently is for the number of tests they can process?
I thought it was 75, but I think it's increased from that, and that's drive-through. The Jefferson Healthcare also does testing in the respiratory clinic and their urgent care clinic, and you know, in the emergency room as well. And for urgent testing, they can do some in-house in their lab, which just takes a couple hours. So we do have that capacity for people who are seriously ill, but for the routine testing, and what they clearly do not have capacity for is people who want testing prior to travel or coming back from travel, which are not unreasonable things to do, but we just don't have the capacity to do that. So people have to go more and more. People are going to see in-home kits. Kits that they can collect a sample at home, send it off to a lab, and that will be accepted by an airline. Or even there's a new kit that's going to be a home test that you do in your home. And it appears to be a very high-quality test that rivals the lab-based ones. So that's coming soon. There was a question about, concern about COVID funding being cut off at the end of the year, and that's very true. The Federal CARES Act ends on December 30th. For some reason, it's not the 31st, it's the 30th is when it ends. And we expected that to be reauthorized months ago. And I don't have, words fail me in how irresponsible this is at a national level. So I'll leave it at that. I wrote some descriptions here, but I won't even read them. There was a question, what systems are in place to notify people with underlying health conditions to come in and get vaccinated? And we're dealing with that. We had a big local meeting on Friday to kind of pull together all the people that will be involved in distributing the COVID vaccine. And we have a number of complicated priorities. And the first priorities are going to go to frontline healthcare workers and first responders. But gradually, as more and more vaccine becomes available, we will be seeking out the people first with the highest risk health conditions, and then really all health conditions in a prioritized way. And part of it will be that the ones with the highest risk conditions are generally in medical care. So we already know who they are. We can contact them through their healthcare providers. For others, it's going to be getting the word out as to, you know, who's eligible and how to get the vaccine. And eventually, and hopefully by April or so, we'll just have enough vaccine. Anyone who wants it can get it. And then we'll be into the mass vaccination mode, because we want to use the vaccine we get as quickly as possible, not only to assure it has the best effect, but to bring the pandemic to a close. You know, that's what it's going to take, is to get the population immunity up to the point that it stops the pandemic. If we just let that happen naturally, it will take years, but we can speed up the process with a vaccine. And there was another vaccine question that asked about military, fire departments, police, and a lot of them are in that first tier, that first responder. And what first responder is really about is the people who are having frontline day-to-day contact with people who are COVID infected. Not only are they at greatest risk of exposure, but also if they're critical workers. So if they get sick or if they get isolated or quarantined, they're not available to work, and we don't have anyone to replace them. So that's why we try to explain to people, COVID vaccine priorities are not based on your worthiness as a human being. Everybody is equally worthy. It's what we need to do to bring the pandemic to an end and what we have to do to save lives. Those are kind of our overriding priorities. The question, quite a list. It was a question about traveling out of county to places like Costco and Home Depot, and are these trips placing people at risk? And the blunt truth is, yes, the risk is going up. As prevalence goes up, as more and more people have the infection and are moving around in society, your risk of encountering one goes up. And so now is the time to really carefully consider what you're doing and be very conscious of doing all of the things that hopefully people have learned. And also I recommend in these big stores, virtually all of them publish when their busiest times are and when their lowest volume times are. And if you want to be at lower risk, pick out the times where volume is lowest. It's typically in grocery stores, it's like, Friday evening or 8 or 9 o'clock at night or early in the morning. But you can find out from the stores when those times are and go at low volume at times, because going under crowded conditions is where your risk is the highest. And those stores are doing a lot to try to prevent risk. But it goes up. That's why we're seeing the outbreaks we're seeing, is the things that used to be safe to do are no longer as safe as they were. And then a few things about the vaccines. And one was, is the new vaccines, are they going to be susceptible to virus mutation? And fortunately, the pandemic coronavirus has not been mutating in the way that influenza has. We have no guarantees it will stay that way, but right now we think the vaccine, the virus is stable enough that the vaccine will work for at least for this phase of the pandemic. So that's not a big concern. There were questions about side effects, and those are things we don't really know yet. The first of the vaccines, the Pfizer vaccine, they just applied for the emergency licensure on Friday, which means they submitted their data. It's being reviewed now kind of behind the scenes, but in the first week of December, it's supposed to all be public. So as it goes into these public review processes, we'll know what their data is. What they're reporting so far is the side effects have been remarkably mild, kind of a lot like flu shots. Your arm gets sore, you might feel some achiness for a few days, and that's what you expect for vaccines. They activate your immune system. And so you feel like you're coming down with something, but it's a good thing. They also ask, the question asks about, is there going to be preservatives like mercury-containing preservatives or formaldehyde? And I couldn't find any information about that. It's possible they will put preservatives in it because they are multi-use vials. Each vial of the Pfizer vaccine will have 10 doses in it, we are told. So more on that. That will be known, you know, once we get more data on it. And then the final two questions, do HEPA air filters placed in rooms, these portable filters, do they help? And the answer is probably yes. They in two ways, that if you're filtering the air, you are taking aerosols that might be in the air out of circulation, and you're also increasing the movement of air in the room, which is a desirable thing. So I'm not aware of any really good studies on these, but in theory, at least, they are helpful. It also asks if it's still a good idea to leave a window open. And the answer to that is yes, too. Air exchange, bringing in fresh air, that's been beneficial as well. You can do that in a variety of different ways. Some people, you can set your ventilation system to increase the air exchange, and there's ways of capturing the heat. And then the final question, what expertise is being called upon to increase ventilation in schools? And you know, we have state standards, and as many know, we have a local consultant, University of Washington professor emeritus in this. I don't know if he wants his name publicly revealed, but most people have met him by now, and he's been very generous with his time, going around and consulting with the schools and helping them optimize their ventilation. So that's been an example of the kind of volunteerism that we've seen in response to this emergency, and always very much appreciated. So I think that's it. I got through the questions, and Willie's got 14 minutes here.
Wow, so much time. We're making up for last week. Any last questions for Dr. Locke before we pass off to Willie?
I just think it would be good to address the fact that schools are doing a pause on in-person learning. Can you speak to that a little bit, how that decision was made and what we can expect perhaps after the Christmas holiday?
Yes, we did meet with the schools on Friday afternoon into the evening, and every school, I think, will be a little different. It's not a crisis setting, so... They see the trend is, even though we're not at this 200 cases per 100,000 yet, we're going there, so they're modifying their practices and their large scale in person education. They are going to take a pause on that. My understanding is they'll continue to offer in person education for special needs students and students who maybe are not doing well on remote education. I've encouraged them to consider that because the irony of all of this is the schools are one of the safest places in the county, given all the stringent methods that they're using to control transmission. But operating a school in the midst of a high prevalence pandemic is you're just constantly battling these importation of cases. So student gets sick, parents or staff get the infection, you have to quarantine classes, you have to shut your school down for 2 weeks and then open it again. And it really interferes with your educational mission. That's the decision they've made. But they'll do it in a unique way for each school district.
So is it fair to say that, you know, if indeed we are able to, and I realize this isn't your decision alone to make, but do you think it's fair to say that if we do a good job in the next month or so of containing community spread of the virus, that we might expect schools to be able to open again then after, in the new year?
I would absolutely hope for that. Is that it, you know, we have the holiday season, the way it's shaping up is really concerning. But we know we can put a lid on this. We did it in March. We can do it again. So we can drop transmission. You know, every 2 weeks, it's a new group of people. Every 2 weeks, you either get, if you get infected, you get better or you end up in the hospital. And then so, but if we can reduce the number of new cases, the rates will drop dramatically. But it takes about 3 weeks. Every time we do something, it takes about 3 weeks for it to have an effect.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's such an important talking point for the community that if we can do a good job, we get kids back in school, we get parents back to work.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
Well, Willie, you get 11 minutes. Take it away.
I knew 16 was too good to be true. So my question for this week had to do with the concept of field hospitals. I'm specifically asking kind of what the triggers would be to open up a field hospital here in Jefferson County. And so for those of you that are unfamiliar with that concept, a field hospital is basically a temporary pop-up hospital that was initially used in military applications. But during disasters or other major incidents like COVID-19, could be used to augment our regular healthcare capacity if that capacity became overwhelmed. So that being that all of the hospital beds are full and we have to open up a temporary solution to help offset the strain and provide medical care for the people who need it. Early on, we did do some initial planning on the viability of a field hospital here in Jefferson County, because we were worried that we may exceed the local health care's capacity during the onset. However, fortunately, Jefferson Healthcare did a lot of really great internal planning on being able to expand capacity just within the hospital. So at the EOC, we are holding on to some additional beds in case they do need to add those to their core facility. They do have other plans to be able to expand, again, from their normal day-to-day bed capacity and expand further and further to be able to provide additional treatment if they are overwhelmed. Beyond that, if they did reach that kind of expanded capacity, we obviously look to some of our regional partners, hospitals outside of the area, to take on patients, kind of like what we saw when Idaho a couple weeks back was nearing capacity and we're actually transporting patients all the way to Seattle and Portland. But again, there is the real distinct possibility that our regional partners might be overwhelmed as well. And that's when, rather than looking at a field hospital kind of owned and operated solely here in Jefferson County, we look at a larger regional facility supported by the state and federal government. And, it seems like a long time ago, a lot of you might not even remember this, but all the way back in late March, early April, there was a federal field hospital being opened up at CenturyLink Field in Seattle. We were lucky enough that field hospital didn't treat a single patient before the federal government recognized that Washington was starting to do well enough and there were other places that were in more desperate need, that field hospital was really nothing more than an exercise in opening that up. They quickly immobilized it and then transported it and opened it elsewhere. But if things really did get that bad here in the region, we would look at that kind of regional facility first and foremost. There are other states right now looking at opening a field hospital with their National Guard in the area because their hospitals are becoming overwhelmed. I believe I read Missouri was the latest as of this morning who's laying their opt-ins. Internationally, I know that Greece, their military is opening up a field hospital as their healthcare facilities are overwhelmed. So it's again, not a good look. A lot of places across the globe are not doing particularly well and having to consider, again, these expanded kind of temporary facilities. Right now, though, the question kind of concerned what the trigger would be. And obviously, the trigger is we're expecting to exceed our healthcare capacity to include that internal expanded capacity that Jefferson Healthcare had planned for. Right now, the models aren't showing that we're scheduled to overwhelm our capacity, although we're certainly making a run at that capacity. Like Dr. Locke said, though, it's not so much the actual bed space itself that's a concern, it's the staffing. There's a ton of turnover. Our healthcare workers have been doing this for nearly a year now, the better part of 9 to 10 months, again, working 12 plus hours a day, working their tails off, trying to provide care for these people. So there's a lot of turnover, they're tired. Maintaining the proper staffing to staff these beds, it is the larger concern right now. The model I'm specifically talking about is from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, or IHME, and this model is actually publicly available. So if you search on Google, just IHME COVID, it'll link you to their webpage, and you can actually see what they're currently projecting. That includes hospital bed usage, ICU bed usage, ventilator usage, number of cases, all that kind of stuff. You can actually go and look for yourself on what the models are currently expect. Obviously, though, those are just models, and the actual outcomes are still up to us and how we actually respond to this Thanksgiving and how we actually intelligently celebrate this holiday and stick to proper COVID protocol. But I still encourage everyone to go look at that slide, kind of maintain awareness as to kind of what's predicted to be going on. Other than that, the only other thing I want to touch on is we are starting to embark on a little bit of an outreach campaign to kind of encourage, to remind folks what the intelligent COVID practices are, and to really provide some encouragement and support as we all really start feeling fatigued and start to struggle through this winter together. Our campaign is called COVID Smart, appropriately, since we starting to recognize that we've learned a lot more about this virus than what we initially did back in March. And so we know what we can do to fight this thing and to be safe and to make smart decisions. And so SMART's actually an acronym. It stands for sanitation, masking, airflow, room between people, and technology gatherings. And they're all the different things that, again, you can do to actually fight this virus, protect yourself, and then, again, most importantly, protect others. So expect to see some stuff via social media, via our website. There are some new PSAs you'll hear on KPTZ 91.9 to the listeners there. And again, just a reminder that we can fight this thing together. We just have to be smart about it, make informed decisions, make sound risk assessments, so that we, like Commissioner Dean said, start getting people back to work, start getting the kids back to school, all that kind of fun stuff. So you'll start seeing some of that here shortly. And again, just want to encourage everyone to be smart about things. We're all in this together. We're all tired. We're all exhausted. But now is crunch time. Now is probably one of the most important points in this pandemic since it all kicked off in March.
Great. Thank you very much, Willie. You kind of addressed one of the questions that was the question that was addressed to us in the KPTZ question as well, which is, just to go a little bit farther, what are the future public health campaigns, in response to the surge that we're going in, as well as that great acronym that from DEM, some of our CARES dollars has gone to the chamber for more messaging on that side. And then, of course, these Monday morning conversations with Dr. Locke and Willie Bentz are, I think, a critical component to keeping the community abreast of the developments, both in response to the COVID-19 and its spread. So, questions for Willie? Okay, well, we still gave you too much time, really. You're just too efficient. But thank you very much for the update and for answering the other question. I like that program a lot. I like the acronym SMART. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Locke. Thank you, Willie Bentz. We do have a packed morning, so we'll let you guys go. And thank you to the listeners of KPTV as well. And we'll release you now and move on with, as they say, a pretty packed schedule. I am wondering if we want to take a quick little bio break, or if people want to soldier on. Bio break it in. All right, let's recess for 5 minutes. We'll, or 7 minutes. We'll come back at 10:35. And I saw Siobhan Canty already on the phone.